Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight familiar, your butt at the party.
And Jake Latondras.
I am bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, didn't say it.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur in the Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi. Good to have you back, Double R. Missed last
week. Rocky?
I know,
but I got a lot done last week, so there's that.
Well, you're out on the road today. Where are you headed to?
Me and Miss Anita are heading to Houston, Texas. Just get a little vacation for a day or so and just put us out on the road. Great thing about me and her, we can work while we're traveling. She got her laptop beaming up to a satellite or something, and I'm driving and talking on the phone, so it's good.
It is. Until you work together as a husband and wife, you know, I will say this. It's hard to, I know for Roy and I, and I'm not going to sit here and say that we're perfect in working together, but buddy, it works, and it works well.
Man, when I left federal government, our biggest fear was there ever going to be too much of each other. And we work right across the desk when I'm actually sitting in the office. And, you know, that can be tough. And even though we're opposites, she's the brains and I'm the good looks, you know, it can still be tough. But I'll tell you, I guess we're 8-9 years into it now, and it's been the best thing for our work and our relationship. It just we really yin and yang good together. And you said it the other day, Rocky, talking about you and Roy Ann's project, you know, everybody should be lucky enough to have a life partner like this, you know?
And then like, I'll tell you this, and I'll say that I don't care. I try to be as transparent of a person there is. Just like last week, we had some my wife, when it comes to talking about things that are controversial sometimes, you know, or she needs help on something, sometimes she finds it hard to say, hey, help me out. And I have to keep saying, tell me. If you need something help-wise outside of my scope, I'm there.
But yeah.
And that's, if you can communicate well, no, you're going to be successful in marriage and a business partnership together.
That's
you've got
right.
You've got to communicate.
That's right. Speaking of communication, we do communicate a tad differently. And I think it's just a he and she issue. Women communicate differently than men. Like, we got that girl down in Argentina that helps us a lot. So I've just noticed, you know, like if I got a problem or something needs to be addressed, I'm just like blurt it out. You know, the kitchen's on
fire.
That's
me. That's me.
You know, but women don't do that. They go, uh-oh. Or they say something that puts a pit in your stomach, but they don't finish. And within a text message or WhatsApp communications, you know, you're like, well spit it out, woman. You know, let's deal with this. And but it's just a difference. They're a little more subtle in coming into it. And you know, I don't know. I'm a boom. The kitchen's on fire. It needs to be put out. You know,
that's me. That is me.
They start talking about, yeah, I haven't back in the house in a while, and something else going on, and, you know, do you smell smoke? And I'm like, you know, and I don't take subtlety at all.
I'm
terrible at that.
I'll tell you this one, Ramsey. The other day, a client came in to pick up an animal. Well, for me, being in the restaurant business, if somebody's walking out with a to-go, I'm holding the door open for them. And if we're not real busy, I'm going to the car and I'm going to open the door that they're going to put the food in. And the other day, and I will admit I handled it a little rough, but I'm like you. I'm a little, let's get this done. So I called everybody in the office and like, listen, we want to set ourselves apart from everybody else in town. That's how everybody else in town is operating. We want to go one step further and be different. We want to communicate with the patients as they come in. We want to help when they come in. We want to hold the door open for them and tell them thank you when they're walking out. Because when they go to these other offices, they're not being told thank you. They're not having a door held open for them. That's going to bring you more business.
Boy, you ain't lying. You know, that's the thing about it is you know, y'all are in the service industry. I'm in the service industry. A lot of us are, and it's not a you've got to build relationships with people. And, you know, answering the phone when people call, returning phone calls, you know, having good and bad discussions, that's just a part of a relationship. And you know, opening a door is just a courtesy, especially down here in the South. Yes, ma'am. No, ma'am. And it's just, you know, it's all about building relationships with people. And I think that's a great policy. And, you know, and I don't get this whole new, I worry about my kids and grandkids. You know, I check myself out at Walmart. I check myself out at Home Depot. It's not that, you know, going into Walmart and talking to the lady that used to check you out was such a big deal. It wasn't. She just works there. She's just drawing a paycheck. She don't care if you shop there, come to her. She don't care. That's always been a problem. But don't you kind of miss back in the old days going to a restaurant and the guy pouring the coffee knew you? Or going to the little mom and pop hardware store that carried everything in stock 24/7, 365, not seasonally stocked like Walmart or somebody. I mean, that was a nice thing. You go in and say, man, I don't really know what I need. And here I'm looking at this and that, and they can put their hands right on it. You know, just go through all them little screw and tack drawers and pull something out. I miss that. You know, service is gone to the devil. Customer service has just gone to the devil in this day and age. And it's like, and what I'm starting to see is that people don't even expect it anymore like they used to. I've handwritten letters to people. You know, if somebody calls up, our catalog is online in PDF form. We hand it out. We mail them out. We do different things. But every now and again, an old guy that doesn't really do much on computer will call and ask for a mailed copy. Well, I don't just stick a brochure in an envelope, lick the stamp, and go. I'll write a little note, you know, hey, thank you very much. Look forward to working with you. And I get phone calls now. They said, son, it's been 10, 15, whatever years since I saw a handwritten note. And I appreciate you doing that. I mean, you know, it's kind of scary on both sides, you know, that one, that we don't get it anymore. And two, that people don't expect it anymore. We do expect it. We should expect it. Man, if I'm going to go lay $40, $50, $60, $100 at a restaurant, I hate to say it, man. I don't care what the rule of thumb tip is. I'm not that guy. I'm not going to give you a tip just because that's what the normal is. I don't care. I don't care what you make an hour, honey. My iced tea glass, I better be felt like I'm waiting on, like you care about my business, like you care about my feet under your table. That's just how I am, dude. And I feel like I tip fairly generously when the service is good and polite and customer service. And there's a restaurant there in Flowood we eat at a little bit. And I'm not just crazy about the food. You know, I'm a hole in the wall kind of guy, but But I never will forget, we went in a couple of years ago at Mother's Day, and they were slammed. I mean, they were slammed. And I didn't really think it took too terribly long. I mean, we got sat at the table when we did, and they brought our drinks out. But I'd say probably 25, 30 minutes, maybe longer, wait before, between time we ordered, time we got served. And nobody, we were having such a great conversation, me and my mom and my wife and my kids, we were having such a great conversation. We weren't in a hurry to go anywhere. We didn't have anything else to do. But see, the whole purpose was sit down and visit as a family anyway. And, but I tell you this, that manager walked out himself and said, I'd like to bring y'all desserts. I'd like to wave your feet. I'd like to do. I'm like, sir, we're fine. It just means a lot that you cared enough about the reputation of your restaurant to step out and have this conversation. Because it really did. I mean, think about that, Rocky. I mean, the man just was hectic. He was just slammed. But he was coming by on some of these tables that had taken a little time for the order to turn around back in the kitchen and apologizing and comping and doing things. And, man, that's just unheard of, you know. And I don't know how y'all's household is, but sometimes, you know, we might plan on eating at 6, but we don't get around to sitting down until 6:30 because life happens, you know. And that sometimes happens in a restaurant, too. But what I don't like is when you go in there and they feel like, you know, it's almost like they're offended, you know. I had a client the other day. He went to New Zealand, and not with me, just kind of went on his own. I see him at SEI a lot. He's more a big game hunter than bird hunter. But he went to New Zealand, and when he landed in customs, coming back home to the U.S., he'd been to this beautiful country with great hospitality and a hospitality service, and of course he got his animals, but he just had this wonderful time in this enchanting country. And he lands in Houston, Texas, and he said between the time they debarked off the plane and got to where they showed their passport, he counted 20-something airport employees sitting in rocking chairs, playing on their phones, do nothing, just sitting there, no help, no nothing, drawing a paycheck. And, you know, and he and I had that conversation. I said, well, you know, service isn't expected anymore, especially in that industry. Service and hospitality is not expected anymore, and I think that any of us that are in business for ourselves, whether it's veterinary or air conditioning or travel or whatever, I mean, service is everything. And people, I think people still feel it, but I do wonder, and I'll shut up about it, you know, how far along it's going to be my kids, my grandkids, before they're not expecting service. You know, they're so used to a generation or two of going and checking yourself out at Home Depot, having shopped for yourself and trying to find where they moved.
Man, something, you know, right.
When are you going to just quit expecting service?
Man, at the end of the day, you brought up Walmart and Home Depot. I will not, unless I am in super in a hurry and I don't have but one little small item and got a couple of bucks to pay for that one item or whatever, I will not go through a self-checkout. Because at the end of the day, the self-checkout, all you're doing is putting somebody out of a job.
Well, and look at Amazon. I mean, really and truly, one click, boom. Tell me one thing that you need that you can't get at Amazon, just one click away, boom. There's no customer service, no human interaction, no nothing. Just pick out your phone, Google it, boom, bing, bam. It's going to be at your door in 2 days. No human act, no service, no customer. And I mean, just boom, comes to you, fully automated. And that's the way of the world, except that if you're selling something that you buy on Amazon, that's one thing. But if you're in our business, Rocky, service is everything. Because, I mean, to get a pet groomed, to get a dog looked at, to get heartworm pills, to buy duck hunts, you can do that anywhere. They're going to come to your door because of how you make them feel. And that's a big deal.
Exactly. Well, here's the deal. It used to be in the old school way of doing things in the veterinary business was it was very hands-on. You walked into an exam room. You were there with the doctor and the vet tech while they were doing service. Well, now, doctors have gotten to the point they don't want to deal with people. They want their techs and their receptionists dealing with the people. And see, I think that it means the world to people to be able to communicate with their doctor when it pertains to pets.
I guarantee you. Or themselves. Or themselves. Rocky, I've got another client who's become a very good friend. Very good friend. He's a surgeon. And a couple of years ago, he did an Instagram page. He started becoming a little more active in social media. And really, I think he's got a very interesting page. I follow him. He ain't got a massive following, but he's got a good following. They put up some real cheeky content, you know, and pretty in line with what he does. And I was on the phone with him one day. He said, man, he said, do you get, you know, like text messages and inboxes and stuff asking you, you know? I said, yeah, all the time. He said, I don't know. I'm just not used to it, I guess. I said, I'm really starting to reconsider this whole social media experiment because, you know, here I am eating dinner with my family at a nice restaurant, and I'm getting inboxes asking me technical questions that normally, historically, they come into my door. And they're sitting in my clinic, you know, before we have that conversation. And I said, dude, that's the whole point. I said, the medical field is so much, and we're talking about people, not pets, but still, you know, the medical field is so much. I mean, dead gum, man, if I didn't know you personally, I'd have to talk to 5 or 10 people before I see you in 3 weeks.
That's right.
I said, and that's the whole beautiful thing is that, you know, by taking a moment here or moments there, you know, out of your time, out of your personal time to talk to these people, you're setting yourself apart. And you're making yourself accessible, maybe more accessible than what you're comfortable with right now or than what you're used to being. But that's the whole point. It's transparent. It's building relationships. I mean, this whole social media thing is real weird to a guy like me that didn't really learn how to do a computer till his early 20s. I mean, literally turn one on and type a Word document. They didn't have computers. I mean, I remember Forrest playing on Roger Rabbit computer program, man, at 2 years old, he could come in and throw in a floppy and turn on the computer and play the little game, you know. Man, I was a grown man, a few years away from being married before I even turned on the computer. I remember my palms sweating when I did that, only because a professor made me do it. And I would have still been handwriting term papers had he not. And, but, you know, this whole social media, on the one hand, I feel like a little wind-up monkey in a vest clapping cymbals for cheap entertainment. But on the other hand, by communicating things of interest, things of knowledge, importance, whatever, you know, you're putting yourself out there in a transparent way to where people kind of know you more than they would if you were just on television or something like that, because they can interact with you if they choose to. They can then write you emails or phone calls if they go to your webpage. That's a whole new frontier. It freaked me out one time. I was in Dallas Safari Club about 6 or 7 years ago, and a young man came up. I say young, he's 22, 23, and was asking me about my kids and talking about a hunt I'd been on. And, man, he was real sorry that my dog had died a few months prior to that. I was sitting there the whole time wondering who this guy is. And finally I said, excuse me, remind me your name again. He said, well, I'm so-and-so. We're Facebook friends. I'm like, wow. This guy didn't live within 3 states of me. But he knew me. You see?
Yeah. And
that's kind of a good thing. I mean, it's kind of along the same thing. And my veterinarian, so you know it, Rocky, there in Brandon, he's a smart guy, and you know, when I come in, it's a level of, now I used this vet, actually before I knew him, and I had another one of his vets there in the office, you know, waiting with me on some things, but eventually I got to know him, we hit it off, and I get texts from him, I get emails, you know, when I, you know, like taking a dog out of the country is kind of a big deal. There's, going to Mexico, it's a stack of papers, you know, of all kinds of forms that got to be filled out just right. And man, this guy, he'll run over to USDA sometimes and get something and explain it all to me, so I don't, you know, act like an idiot coming through and then when I bring my dogs in, you know, it's just a real I tell you, it reminds me of back in the 1970s when my grandfather would take his dogs to Dr. Royal there in Greenville. And boom, I mean, they were family friends, you know, and that there's a lot to be said for that, I think. You know, and I find myself banking insurance or just anything I do, medicine, buying T-shirts, coats. I mean, I really find myself gravitating. I want a relationship with the people I do business with. And you know what, Rocky, buying a car, I'll pay a little bit more, not crazy money more, but I'm willing to pay a little bit more buying it from somebody I know and have a trusted relationship with than just Joe Blow the stranger to save $100. You know, that's just my uncle one time, who was a pretty successful businessman, he told me, he said, you know, and I don't bank a lot in terms of borrowing capital and things like that, but what I did, you know, back when we were buying houses and building families and a growing family and all the kind of stuff when you're young. But, hey, I never forget. He told me, he said, you know, build a good relationship with your banker. And you know, who cares if it's another percent or two? Who cares if it's a point or two higher on a loan? Have a good relationship with that guy and it'll pay off. You know, right. It did pay off. You find a deal of a lifetime on a truck on a Saturday. And you call him at home and he says, oh, yeah, just go ahead and buy it and come by Monday and we'll get it all figured out. I mean, you know, there's a lot to be said for that.
Yeah.
You know, that's just personal relationships are so much. But, boy, I tell you, quickly, this whole Internet experience is changing the world, changing the way people think.
I hate to do this today, but our conversation is going there. This conversation you and I had yesterday, or 2 days ago, I received a call Monday night, and it's an introduction by Jake Latondras. He said, listen, he sent me a text the other day. He said, look, I know I've been busy. I haven't been on the podcast much, but I got a couple of ideas for people that you need to bring on when you finish up with the stories that you have right now. I said, well, who do you have in mind, Jake? And one of them was Lee Chose, which is, to our generation, one of the most known photographers and I'm not going to say he's controversial.
He's iconic. Lee, the long list of truly iconic photos that Lee has taken during his career is nothing short of utterly amazing. I follow him on Instagram. I keep up
Jeff
with
Foles
him. Jeff
Foles said
him.
That he made him. Jeff Foles admitted
it
on the podcast.
Yeah. When I heard Jeff say that, I knew exactly which photo he was talking about, too. He was talking about a photo, and all I remember is stormy sky, cloudy sky. And I don't even know what they were advertising, but I'll never forget the picture. Jeff had his classic face paint on, but his yellow lab had face paint on too. And that was just a cool photo. And that was just Lee Chose right there. And you know, Lee's worked for all the industry leaders, and if you get to know him and talk to him, he's just a wealth of been there, done that wisdom. You know, I'd love to hear him on your podcast. I mean, you know, how things have changed in the industry. I tell you, ask Lee Chose what you asked me a month or so ago about finding a career in the outdoor industry, or how to and ask him about these guys that are buying this these $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 setup and slinging lenses wanting to be the hottest thing since sliced bread in the outdoor world. Ask Lee that thing, what he's seen change. But Lee's a very, very, very serious and interesting guy. You know, I saw him in Dallas. Go ahead.
No. I was just going to say that Lee and I communicated there through text a couple of times, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. But the one that really threw me for a loop is a good friend of yours. And Monday night, as I sat there and recorded with Brian Warden, I got this phone call from a 214 number. And I was like, well, man, this is nothing but a a scam call to pay your IRS bill or fix your, you know, get an auto warranty, blah, blah, blah. Well, when I got off the phone, I noticed I had a voicemail. And it was from John LaMonaco. He's a good friend of yours, Ramsey. And he had been introduced earlier in the day through text from Jake. He's a him and Jake are best friends. And he just wanted to he is from the old school of thought. He could sit there and text with me all day long. He wanted to know me. He wanted to talk to me. He wanted to feel me like it was done in the old days. And man, there's nothing but appreciation and respect for somebody like that.
John is a old class gentleman. And you know, Ramsey, I consider him a friend.
Please tell the podcast audience the interaction of how it all started between and John about John. John had hunted everywhere, killed anything that you can imagine.
Oh boy. Man, that guy has hunted countries I don't know really that you can hunt anymore. His lifetime achievements in the big game world are sheep and the animals that, you know, you just, I'd never even heard of, beyond a lot of those ibex and markhors, and he's been on the cover of Ovis magazine at least four times, which being on the cover of Ovis magazine, if you're a sheep hunter, is a big deal. Four times. You know, and I really don't know. I should know. I know he's told me how old Mr. John is. He's in his 80s, but I can tell you this, to be in a duck blind with him, he and Jake and I and Forrest hunted in Wyoming and Nebraska, and his mind is as sharp as a college kid. I mean, just sharp as a tack. His wit's intact. And golly, I hope I'm in that kind of shape when I'm him, because his reflexes are quick as a snake. you know, those birds come in, and Forrest and I don't have any advantage over John. I'm telling you, and he can shoot, because despite all those big game accomplishments, bird hunting, duck hunting is his thing. It like a lot of guys I've known, that have hunted big game and done those things, his heartbeat is waterfowl. And some of the places that he has owned and hunted, and I'm not going to steal his thunder, it's a story y'all need to hear, are nothing short of astounding. He's like the true modern-day Nash Buckingham of epic proportions. And I'll tell you how I met John.
Let me preface this real quick, Ramsey. What you're about to hear from Ramsey is how the world's supposed to work. We live in a day and age.
That's exactly right.
We live in a day and age where people do things for other people because it may advance them. It's about them at the end of the day. It's from a selfish standpoint. What Ramsey's about to tell you is how the old days used to work. And, you know, it's an amazing story of how him and John came together and became friends.
You know, you've heard me say a lot of times that I love to hunt. I love the whole thing about it, but increasingly people, I love people. And John's that kind of guy you meet that just throws steroids on that notion. And you know, I'm friends with John. I revere him as a friend. But really and truly, he's more than that. You know, unwittingly, not intentionally, he's a mentor. Several times has he done or said things that really and truly impacted my life forever. And he's a hero. I mean, he really truly is. Just the way he is. You know, John is that guy that smiles when he talks all the time. He smiles when he talks, and his eyes sparkle. He's a happy guy, a very, very successful guy because of his people skills. And But when I met John, I didn't know all this. I was down in Argentina, and I, 7-8 years ago, 9-10 years ago, you know, I think it was around 2009 or 2010, I was down in Argentina. And I'd been down there a while. I was jumping around, meeting a few outfitters, and trying to piece together the perfect offerings, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, but have the perfect partners to work with down there. And I'd gone up to the province of Santa Fe, San Javier, right up against the river. And it was, you know, ducks in the morning, ducks in the evening, blah, blah, blah. But it was just real cookie cutter. And at that camp that time was a real dandy guy. Let's just say they were just real. The guy was a powerful international attorney from somewhere up north. And he was going to be in camp while I was in camp. The outfitter introduced us while we were both in BA. And we were going to eat lunch. And just to make conversation in the cab, right, I said, so what do you do? The guy took a long breath through his nose. He breathed like that, and he goes, gave it a lot of thought, and he goes, well, Ramsey, only poor people do. And I'm like, good Lord, I got to spend 3 days with this guy? You know, that's what I said to myself. And I went up there on this hunt with him, and it was okay. We shot ducks in the morning, ducks in the evening, and we ate steak, and we did this and did that. And I guess if you'd never been to Argentina, it was better than hunting Warren County, Mississippi in the year 2019. But having been to Argentina around South America, it just wasn't that big a deal. It didn't impress me at all. And after 3 days, I won over this guy, and we were friends, and he told me some politically incorrect jokes. Looked over both his shoulders, you know, to make sure nobody else was listening. But with my accent, I get to hear those jokes. There weren't any jokes I hadn't heard before. And he shared a Cuban cigar, and we were out there smoking cigar and drinking wine. And he said, man, what a great hunt. Now, let me tell you this. I think this is why. Let me back up. This was important because the first morning we're going out to hunt. And I got my gun, you know, my 20-gauge shotgun I borrowed from the outfitter, and something's going on behind the truck on the tailgate of the truck, and I can't, you know, figure out why we're not stepping down the trail already, because I can see the orange in the sky to the east. We need to be out there getting ready to shoot ducks. And, well, this guy's putting together a 28-gauge Perazzi shotgun, a $40,000 shotgun he's putting together in the dark. I'm like, oh, my gosh. Now, I really don't like this guy. Who brings a $40,000 shotgun, a 28-gauge? Are you kidding me? To a duck hole like this. Well, let me tell you what, the minute I started seeing 50 yarders wide up with that 28-gauge, I realized this guy could shoot. But he gets his gun assembled. We cross the fence, and when we get the guide indicates in Spanish, whoa, those two pegs right there, there's supposed to be a footbridge going across it, but the water's a little higher, and it's floated it off, so take a big step because there's no bridge. It's deep there. I go, how big a step? Big. I mean, you know, you can't see nothing but just muddy water. Is it 2 foot, 5 foot, 10 foot wide? I mean, I got to jump. I need to run up, sprint, and try to pole vault over this thing? He just said, mucho. So I gave it all I had and hit dry ground on the other side and started on down the trail. You know, and I get about 5 yards and hear a kasploosh. Well, my partner there from the big city that didn't do because he didn't have to do, when I looked back my headlight on him, all I saw was his wristwatch and the hand holding that Perazzi shotgun. The rest of them was underwater making bubbles. And the bird boys had done bailed off into the ditch and tried to get him out. But he was dead weight. He wouldn't move. He wasn't letting that gun get in the water. And they couldn't understand, you know, I'm thinking, my God, he's going to drown. So I went back over and reached out as far as I could, and I took his gun. And the minute that gun was safe, well, now he started helping himself get out of the water. So he was soaking wet, and I swear he was making 50 yarders with that 28-gauge. I was highly impressed. He told me he'd been shooting a 28-gauge since he was 8 years old, and 12-gauges had become antiquated in the Eisenhower administration. You know, that was just him, the guy he was. And so we kind of clicked along. This is not John LaMonaco. I'm leading up to that. And that last night, smoking cigars, his cigars, talking, he invited me to come eat dinner at a restaurant that I always eat at, an Italian restaurant in town. I said, great, I'll meet you at such and such o'clock. He says, you do have a sport coat, don't you? I said, no, I ain't had a sport coat since I was a frat rat. He said, well, you got to have a sport coat to get in this restaurant. I said, I ain't got a sport coat. I ain't going to buy a sport coat. All that restaurant sees is my money. He wouldn't go to that restaurant with me. So we went to another restaurant. And he bought, and that's fine. But we got to talking that evening, and he says, well, man, isn't this a great hunt? When you come back, what do you think? Are you going to sell it? How many do you think you'll sell? I said, oh, I'll never be back here. He goes, what? I said, no. He said, well, we shot our duck. I said, yeah, we shot our ducks. We're the only people they've had in a month. They could have salted any hole out here and had those number of ducks we shot. I said, but besides that, it's all about the details. You know, it's just the deep. I said, first and foremost, the footbridge that you dang near drowned over. That should never happen to a client. People fall in, don't get me wrong, but not because of that. Nobody should ever have to do that. And I said, you know, the owner's son, who's an artist. He went into great detail when you asked him what he did about being an artist. He's an artist. I said, did you not ever notice that it was beneath him to hand you ammo? I said, and what about this and this and this and this and this and this and this? No, I'm not interested in representing this hunt. It's just a mediocre cookie cutter hunt down here. I could care less. And when we ate dinner that night in town, he said, you know, Ramsey, I didn't see all that until you named it. He was there several days after me. He said, but I quit enjoying the hunt because that's all I could see was those items you had said that I hadn't noticed. He said, and me and Nacho there had words the last day because of his attitude. And I shrugged and said, well, you know, I do this for a living, right? So break, back on story with John LaMonaco. The same outfitter had a hunt down in Cordoba, and he invited me to come over and sit in the lodge with him for a few days and hunt, join some guests he had. And we stopped somewhere along the way. I flew into Cordoba and drove about, I don't know, 2 hours north to the new roost, Wascate Roost at the time, north of Macha. And we stopped. I met a guy. He had to stop and talk to a guy that was coming out, and it was a real, real prominent outfitter from Asia that specializes in markhors and Argali sheep and Ibex. I mean, this guy has the prime real estate. It's like in the city of Manhattan, this guy's business is the World Trade Center. You follow what I'm saying? This is a big, I was like, wow, how are you doing? Glad to meet you. And we talked a little bit, and it took me a while to put two and two together, and that's what I'm leading up to in this story. So we went on up to the lodge, and there I met a husband and his wife, John LaMonaco, and his beautiful wife, Robin. And we had camp to ourselves, and we hit it off. John had never met a stranger. He's never met a bad guy. You know, he's just that guy. You just hit it off with him. And we hit it off, and we enjoyed a few mornings of an afternoons of dove hunting and got to know him. And I never will forget one night, I was showing him my book at the time, my little show book I carried around to show people, you know, the pictures and my little hardbound book that I made to carry to conventions. And he loved it. And then he broke out his book, his first book, and started showing me and telling me stories. And he got to telling me this story. I don't remember what he was hunting. That's beside the point. He was up in the mountains. He was in Pakistan, and he looked Pakistani. I mean, the way he was dressed and the way he had his head wrapped. And I said, man, wasn't you a little scared of sticking out to a Marine sniper? He said, not as scared as I was standing out to the Taliban. You know, he said, that's, you know, when in Rome. and went in Rome, Ramsey. But he got to telling me the story about that particular guide he was with in this picture, about how they had been on some epic hunts, had spent just dozens of nights, many nights in different parts of the country chasing different species, and how even though they didn't speak the same language, they had just bonded and formed friendships, and how after he killed that animal, the guy was moping a little bit, and just through hand gestures and whatnot indicated to John that he was sad because he knew John would never come back, that he was done, and that he would never see John again. And then as John was telling me this story, a tear rolled down his cheek, you know, because he obviously cared about this guy a lot. And that's just, you know, he's a very sincere person. And so we left and parted ways and shook hands and swapped telephone numbers. I had to leave, go somewhere else to scout. And, you know, the following fall, I was at the Jackson show there at the Little Extravaganza. And there was another person from Hinds County who became a client, who we ended up becoming friends. But the first couple of times he kind of come by the booth and made the rounds at that show, he was a little standoffish. This man was very, very accomplished in his own self. He shot 3 or 4 dozen Cape buffaloes and lions and elephants. I mean, this man was a very, very accomplished big game hunter. That had an incredibly impressive game room right there in Hinds County. But the first couple of times he was just kind of stand out there about 20, 30 feet. I was a nobody. You know, he didn't know me, and, you know, he didn't want to get a sales pitch. And we had I had a bar built for my booth at the time. I could put everything in. It was on wheels, and I could roll it out to the truck. And when we made this big bar contraption, my buddy Millhouse said, "Well, how tall do you want it? About the height of a table?" I said, "No." I said, "Hang on a second." I walked out to my driveway, and I measured to the top of my tailgate on my truck, whatever that was, 43 inches or 50 inches or whatever. He goes, "My goodness, Ramsey." He said, That's tall as the back of a truck. I said, "Well, that's what I just measured." He says, "Why you want that tall?" I said, "Well, it'll hold more stuff, so it's practical. But if I can get people to come and stand there and put their elbow up, we can have a talk. They ain't going nowhere." And when my buddy came by that I wasn't friends with quite yet, I had a game plan for this year. When he came by, I knew he stopped and talked to me, but from a distance. And I had a plan for how I was going to get him into conversational level and win him over. And he came up, we were talking about Africa, favorite place he'd ever hunted, but it just at an uncomfortable distance for me, you know. I mean, he must have been 10, 15 feet away. Wouldn't get no closer. So I reached in my pocket, and I pulled out John LaMonaco's business card. And on his business card, it was him. He had a picture of himself holding a straight-horned Mercor. And he, you know, had his head wrapped up and all that good stuff in the picture. And I said, "Well, you've traveled all over the world. What kind of animal is this?" And Buddy, from 10, 15 feet, he saw that Mercor and closed the distance. He said, "Well, that's a Mercor from such and such, such range," and blah, 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 you know, and he knew all about it. And he said, "And you know this guy?" I said, "Yes, we hunted down in Argentina." And, you know, he ended up putting his elbow on my bar, like leaning up against a pickup truck. And we sat there and had about a 30-minute conversation. We just got to know each other a little bit. And turns out we all had some common friends from Hinds County. And he became a client, then a friend, and in many ways a mentor in his own self. And he told me at the end of that conversation, he said, "Ramsey, I've heard things about you." And he says, "Do you go to Dallas Safari Club?" I go, "No, sir. Should I?" He goes, "Yeah, you really need to." He said, that's the market you need to be in if you're going to be successful in this business.
Well, and Ramsey, next week.
All right.
I want to further this because this is when the story really gets good. And it goes back to the principle that I was talking about when I preface this. White life is about friendships, relationships. I think the story of a man's life is not how well he can be there for somebody that's in a higher position for him, but it's being there for the people that, and don't expect anything in return for somebody that may be just starting out in life, starting out in business.
Mm-mm. You're right, Rocky.
You understand what I'm getting at?
We all know we can't take it with us. And if we leave a bunch money, that just means our kids are going to fly first class everywhere they go. But what you really leave behind is how you impact people's lives. And this is the story of John LaMonaco, but I'm just giving you a lot of perspective on it. This is my story, my relationship, and how this man, that relationship with him not even trying, on several occasions has given me pieces of advice that have made me a better person and certainly made me better at what I do or chose to do for a living.
And
it's all about people.
Nothing. And expected nothing in return from you.
No, nothing. Absolutely nothing. Nothing. Nothing at all.
Hey, before I let you go, though, I got to ask you about this. Because next week, like I said, guys, you're really going to enjoy this part of the story. If you don't listen to any other podcast that Ramsey and I do, listen to next week. There's a valuable life lesson in what Ramsey's going to tell next week. Hey, I want to ask you this, though. Conversation with Forrest yesterday morning. How did that go?
Well, I knew when he called and went into a long, drawn-out, step-by-step story that he did not kill that turkey. But it was about a 20-minute, 30-minute version of a story. And then he got quiet. I mean, you know, it wasn't like he made it out to be in Facebook, like this bird stepped up and he pulled the trigger twice. The bird had, he figured the bird out. He got where the bird wanted to be, and he called that bird in. He had to come over a little ridge there in the where he was hunting. So he couldn't see it while it was gobbling coming to him. And when it did, it came down a trail about 25 yards to his right, which is very hard for a right-hand shooter to manipulate it. He got behind a tree and he moved and it started putting out. The story started with the fact that he washed his clothes the night before and forgot to grab his gloves and his face mask. But he was heartbroken. It left a mark, and I didn't even mess with him too bad. I didn't mess with him bad until last night. And then I sent him that old meme, you know, you see, not all Indians were hunters. Some of them had to collect firewood, and I told him, hey, you know, run a landscape business is a good thing. You got a chainsaw on hand. You won't get too bad of blisters on your hand collecting firewood. He didn't respond to that. But, you know, he did that. He went and packed all his stuff at school and got moved out of his apartment or whatever and woke up this morning in Kansas. It didn't deter him one bit, man. He's in Kansas somewhere right now. Him and his buddies chasing turkeys. He's going to make them pay rent when it all lines up just right. He's going to make them pay rent.
Listen, I can't brag enough about Forrest, man. He is a unbelievable gentleman. He's a great outdoorsman. Like I said, when I've taken younger people turkey hunting, I mean, I'm not anywhere. I'm not even halfway a good turkey hunter. But you see it. He's got it. He's got the outdoorsman it. And just a good, respectful guy. Man, he's a good guy.
Good. Thank you. Thank you very much.
So, Ramsey, I know what's coming next week. Should be an awesome podcast. So y'all make sure that you turn in for next week's podcast of the Dallas Safari Club and how that all came about and how John was a part of that. So Ramsey, be careful the rest of your way.
It's a good story. Thank you, Rocky.
Be careful the rest of the way to Houston. Tell Miss Anita we all said hello. Thank you again, bud. We want to thank all of you that listened to this edition of the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckTop.com.